Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
So I'd like to move on then to our second theme for focus today, and this is the design initiative. And the person who will do the introduction of the design initiative will give you a flavor of what design can mean in the context of social sciences is Dean Peter Cowie, who is in the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies, and he currently holds a Qualcomm Endowed Chair in Communication and Technology Policy. Dean Cowie's lecture will focus on one example of what we mean by design, an initiative that was that aims to establish a new structure for policy design and evaluation using lab approaches. And this is an approach that he calls policy design and evaluation laboratories to really integrate what we know about economics, political science, and other social science disciplines to provide novel solutions to very important policy issues regarding global problems. You will see some very exciting examples of how we at UCSD are using data collection, evaluation, analysis to do field experiments and then to drive policy and to do this in an iterative way so that we're learning from each round of iteration to develop better policies that work in real life. And what this really means is a fundamental change in which we are moving away in social sciences from theory and ideology to doing real-time experiments, and that informs the public then of exactly what policy changes are. So these are policies driven by real-life experience out there in the field. And you'll begin to see the connections with what Steve Kay talked about, experiments, data collection, analysis, iteration, and then going on to develop better policies. I also want to say a few words about design. Most of you think of design in the concept as a very interactive, interdisciplinary, and creative activity that is often focused on providing functional, practical solutions to typically aimed at products or objects. But we want to expand this concept of design to include much more than just these specific things. You can think of design as including processes, institutional structures, services, or even our own interactive environment to maximize the human experience and potential to really have societal impact. So design in this view can be informed by research on cognition and perception, communication, as well as by art, history, theater, operations research, and even management principles. And so I'd like you to welcome Peter Cowie to come up to the podium and talk about one aspect of this design initiative.
Thanks very much, Suresh, and thank you all for joining us tonight. I'm going to do two things. The first is to walk you briefly through the bigger picture about design so that you get a sense of what the broader conversation involving the arts and humanities, the social sciences, engineering and the sciences, and the Rady School and my School of International Relations and Pacific Studies is about at that very broad level of design. And then I'm going to take you to the specific area of policy design and evaluation to illustrate some of the things that we hope that we can do in this transformational work at UC San Diego. So what is design? Well, the paradigmatic design of the 21st century so far is the iPad, right? And in some ways, if a design initiative simply made UCSD more likely to produce slick hardware and applications that were like the iPad, that would be a lot. But really, design is about a set of principles. And the first is to imagine the possibilities of transforming our physical or human environment. And imagination is not just wild brainstorming, it's a disciplined form of imagining that breaks the barriers of our conventional work to start opening us to possibilities. And then we prototype solutions. We think about what would this look like as a solution. And if you read the new biography of Steve Jobs, you knew that the next step was iteration. Iteration, iteration, iteration to make sure that the solution really turned into something that made sense, and then a type of ruthless evaluation of what had been achieved at that point. Those principles of design then cover many areas, not just building iPads. So here's one example of design in the arts, a stage set and lighting. It's a product of our own theater arts program, which has a design master's degree. And they have a set of intellectual disciplines on how to comment on the text of a play, to imagine how to imagine a setting that doesn't literally replicate that world of the play, but creates a moment of imagination for us to share that effectively works for the space of the play. And beyond that traditional form of design in the arts, at UC San Diego, we've seen enormous advances in thinking about how other forms of the sciences can interact with the arts. Here is one of the iconic paintings of the 20th century, Picasso's Gertrude Stein portrait. The New York City Ballet reinvented the space of dance and the design of dance space. But at UCSD in cognitive and neurosciences, we've added to that brain imaging in order to be able to see where the brain responds and how to those artistic expressions. And from that has come a new discipline of neuroaesthetics and design, in which literally we start to ask, how is it that the wiring of the brain, those networks that are in the human brain, come together and respond to various artistic expressions, and why some expressions seem to have enduring, powerful effects because of their interaction with our basic cognitive structure. And so we both are creating new tools to understand the artistic experience, but we're also from that getting new analytics for both stretching our imagination about how to do the design of arts and dance, but also at the same time learning from those artistic undertakings about the way our brain works. Now, another form of design is involving social networks, and this is what Steve Kay talked about a little bit earlier. I'm going to show you a type of design problem that is really tied to what we think of as social networking. And what has occurred is that the exact same images that you were seeing with Steve about networks and human biology are being developed and examined with many of the same laws, as Steve said, like power laws, in order to understand how social patterns emerge and can be shaped. This is a picture of a simple form of a social network. Several people, the person in orange in the center, is exemplifying the power of being in between. That person is literally the person most connected to everybody else as a central player, and that gives that person certain types of influence in the social network. Now, when you read the conventional social science about how society works, the typical type of statistical study goes like this. They look at the attributes of people who are interesting, like Mark, right? Mark's a rocket scientist, expert on Area 51, a really rich dean who's well-paid, fancy sports car, right? Right? All those things. And then they take a look at the attributes of me, not so well-paid, really boring, and, you know, is jet-lagged most of the time from getting off a plane. And from that, in running large numbers, we start to get from the attributes of individuals, relationships that we look for to try to discover things like propensity to consume various types of goods and services, or the level of investment in an economy. Well, what this type of analysis is doing is going the exact opposite way. It's saying that the relationship structure itself that is powering what's happening, not the interaction of the attributes of the individuals. So this is a picture of network in which over a number of years, thousands of people were observed regularly on a quarterly basis. And if I could show you the full time series, what you would see is that happiness was networked. And because of the particular structure of this network, it was susceptible to if one small subgroup became happy, it radiated through the network. There are other types of network structures where that radiation would not have taken place. So in looking in the structure of the network, we can start to discover how social behavior and attitudes start to manifest themselves from the small, you and me and a few of our friends, to the large over time. And we can start to ask the question, how can we do interventions? This work, for example, is suggesting new directions in public health intervention. Well, there are some areas that call for redesign. So here's a picture in the center of the office buildings of downtown Atlanta. Very typical of downtown Atlanta. It uses a lot of buildings that are out of the tall, shiny building school of building, which is to say, reflective materials. Also, for all of you who are familiar with Atlanta, Atlanta is an extremely spread out metropolitan area. On the left, you see a comparison of the metropolitan area of Atlanta with the metropolitan area of Barcelona, Spain. They have the exact same population, 2.8 million people, but in that density factor, you have built into it a large amount of commuting, use of energy, and a whole series of other byproducts that we can think of. This is a heat imaging of Atlanta, and basically what it tells you is Atlanta is a hot spot, right? And all those building materials, that spread out population, and a whole series of other patterns in Atlanta make it an energy sink of the worst sort, throwing off huge amounts of heat. We know that one of the challenges we are going to be facing in the world of environmental change that is going to come is going to be dealing with the major generators of heat in the world, urban areas. So the question that we can ask ourselves in design is, are there ways that, A, we can use our skills in engineering to change the engineering solutions to a more friendly pattern? But two, can we do societal design? Can we take that network that I showed you in the last slide and instead of dealing with happiness, start thinking about things that tip behavior, not by government mandate and orders, but by networking attitudes and beliefs to move to, let's say, denser urban build-in and therefore less sprawl and commuting and less heat throw off. So what I've done so far is take you through the notion that there is a world out there of design that takes itself from the ranges that we think of traditionally of designing objects, design in the arts, and then starting to understand that these same notions of opening ourselves up to imagination, starting to prototype solutions, think of the right network structure, for example, and then starting to iterate ways of picturing how you might intervene in that, can open ourselves to new possibilities for serving society or advancing the arts and natural sciences. And so the design initiative, in its broadest sense, will launch a very broad interdisciplinary conversation built around problems rather than disciplinary silos. And it's going to bring design into the classroom. And I want to stress this because one thing that we all agree about in this further development of UCSD is that teaching is, in a sense, prototyping the solutions of the tomorrow. It's where we come together as faculty and work together as teams, testing out ideas and refining them in a conversation with our students, who in the long term will be the people who will really come up with the solutions. And so this is very much deeply an educational project. And in the design initiative, it will lead to new types of studios, policy labs, and experiments, and new types of engagements with the broader community to do design. The big area that we've been spending time on in my area of the social sciences is on what we call policy design and evaluation laboratories. Now, I'm the dean of a school of international relations and Pacific studies, so you might think I have a propensity for long-winded titles for whatever I help design. But we call these policy labs, to be short. But the principles of design and evaluation are core to what we're thinking about here. Basically, what is occurring in the cutting edge of social science, and in many of the faculty members' work here at UCSD, is a shift from these broad categories of what are almost ideologies. I'm a free marketer, I'm a Keynesian, I'm a this or I'm a that, to a much more nuanced, data-driven, experimental view of how to diagnose and solve problems. And so this intellectual development is driven by also by the confluence with the emergence of new centers of power and thought around the world, places like India and China, who aren't convinced that the traditional schools of thought and policy analysis that came out of our experience actually answer the types of questions that they debate, such as how do we reduce poverty? How do we strengthen freedom in various ways? Or how do we understand the consequences of globalization? And so this design initiative is to really build new analytic tools and test smart ideas in the real world. Let me give you a pair of examples in addressing the issue of reducing poverty. First, on public health and economic growth. We all know that disease, besides being an enormous tragedy for the individuals involved, also represents a huge challenge for economic growth because it diverts resources and people. This is a picture of an HIV health campaign in Malawi. It's a typical large-scale public health campaign to try to get people to use condoms. This is a picture of Malawi and the level of HIV/AIDS in Malawi. It is basically one of the highest infection rates in the world, despite all the signs on the left. Professor Craig McIntosh on our faculty was out evaluating the effects of various public health campaigns to reduce HIV and AIDS, and he showed some positive results, but much less than people hoped when things were properly evaluated. But he also noticed from the data that they could pinpoint the big edge where they could cut into the problem, which is in young women who are leaving school at an early age and were essentially without economic resources and tended to become engaged through marriage and elsewhere with itinerant commercial people, especially truckers, who are one of the biggest transmission belts for HIV/AIDS in Africa. And so Craig came up with an idea, a prototype, which they tested, and it was this. Let's pay the families a small stipend to keep the girls in school, and let's see what happens. And they did, and that cash supplement has kept the girls in school for a much longer period of time, and the rate of early marriage and pregnancy has dropped 30 to 40% in the test population, and with it, the HIV/AIDS rate of infection has plummeted as well. Here's another example. We think of India as a place of great engineers, but the rural level of illiteracy is 50%. Why is that? There are still schools out in rural India. It's not an absence of schools. Well, one of our researchers spent a lot of time looking at the data and discovered as he tested and evaluated that 25% of the teachers in rural India don't ever show up at the school to teach. So what he did was start to ask what would cause these teachers to show up because they didn't pay any attention to the orders and the rules. And so through a series of experiments on what they would respond to, he found out that if you pay teachers based on student performance, introduce an evaluation system that you do control, and you have modest teacher bonuses, it will lead to large improvements in school performance. Let me take two other examples on expanding freedom. Honest elections in developing countries, a big challenge. Jimmy Carter became famous for his election monitoring efforts. Here's a picture in Uganda of a recent election. Election monitoring didn't actually work that well because it was all done with paper for all those people who have weak paper trails, and involved tons of paper in really distributed small villages. So Clark Gibson of our political science department got together with Qualcomm and invented a new technique using mobile phones to do election monitoring, turning it into an observational system that worked much more effectively. And with the data, they actually figured out which areas were most likely to have fraud and where to spend the most time monitoring. The result is that they have been showing that they are reducing voting fraud in these elections by 50%. Here's another thing that we say when we go to developing countries. Rule of law. Rule of law. What's the first step? Make things more transparent. Let people see government in action. So Professor Eddie Molesky here at UCSD talked the Vietnamese Communist Party into letting him run an experiment in which members of the National Assembly of Vietnam would be told in experimental control groups which ones were going to be more on the major website in Vietnam and which would be less. Here's a picture of them and of some of the information that they were dealing with. What happened with the legislators who were more on the website, therefore subject to more transparency? This is the response rate of criticism. And what the graph basically shows you is the more exposure the legislator had on the web, the less he criticized the government. The exact opposite of everything we thought. Finally, globalization. I just want to simply point out that globalization, you get these debates about whether it's good or bad. The point about globalization is it breaks the box of our traditional categories. So this is something that Gordon Hansen of our faculty has done in a massive data analysis with his colleagues at MIT. It's a picture of the U.S. response to trade with China. And the takeaway from this is pretty simple. We think of trade with China as the things that put textile workers out of business or most affects places like Detroit. But what they show is that the biggest impacts are in Silicon Valley and the Research Triangle, not in Detroit. But until you did a whole new form of data analysis, you couldn't find the effect. So what the policy labs are going to do is break us out of silos, they're going to develop new data analytics, and they're going to allow us to scale up from a few thousand people in a rural area to dealing with experiments with healthcare systems over the millions. And to be able to do that, we're going to have to combine powerful computational techniques with experiments on the ground and a whole new way of working with our students to engage them as our partners in doing this. And finally, it will require a set of funding partners out there in the world who will engage with us because they have problems they want to solve, and we have ways of breaking through the traditional debates to get a new perspective and handle on how to intervene in the world. That's what we have, one of the largest cadres of social scientists in the United States, ready to do together. This has brought them to think of new ways of experimenting with each other already that they had never thought of before, and it's one of our bets on the future. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.